Welcome.
Well, thank you.
We are recording.
Okay, cool.
All right, do you want to jump into an intro or do you want me to do
sure.
it? How do you want to do it?
Hello and welcome to What If? Creativity in a Nutshell, a podcast brought to you by Berg School of Communication.
So, welcome to episode 3. My name's Adam Horn. I'm creative director at Berg Studio. And once again, I'm joined by...
me, Christopher Waldekrantz. I'm the marketing director here at Berg's in Stockholm.
Okay, so today we're going to talk about... the idea that there's probably a lot more careers that involve creativity, either directly or indirectly, than you think. So we're going to run through three different parts of that. Really, the first part is discussing, you know, what you might want out of your job or your career. Then we're going to talk about how creativity can be applied to almost anything that you do, so it can be added everywhere. And then we'll jump into a discussion about some of the more specific areas where creativity and communication can be your day job or your night job, depending on how well managed you are.
We've all been there, right?
We have all been there. Thankfully, I can say that Sweden's a whole lot better at the work-life balance. But again, we're talking about different podcasts already.
Yeah. Wonderful. Right. So where it can creativity be used, basically, right?
I think it would be a good place to start this is to ask the question about what do you really want from your job and what do you want from your life? And I know these are big questions, but it's like one thing that I see a bit of is that I've got either friends or students or people around me that expect their job to give them every emotional high point and it should be this really fulfilling thing. And I think, like, part of me thinks that's a little bit Californian in a way.
Mm.
And I think sometimes that's a little bit unrealistic to expect your job to be always totally fulfilling, even if it is creative and really rewarding sometimes.
I agree. And I think that especially when you talk about a creative job, because I've been to so many dinners where, you know, you go around the table and people are like, so what do you do? That old question. And as soon as you say that you work with something creative, they're going to be like, oh, that's so inspiring. That's so cool. Tell me, you must have the coolest job ever.
Exactly.
And I'm like, I feel ungrateful because I'm like, yeah, but it's a job. Of course it is fun. And of course I chose it for a reason. But it is a job. And to your point, I think if you expect a job to do the entire sort of list of things that you want in life, then you're set up to fail because your life is so much more than just a job. But the fun thing with creativity and working with something creative is that most of the sort of ideas that I get, at least, they happen outside of the job. So there is a pretty obvious connection between on and off work mode, and the creative brain is constantly working, so it's there, and so the lines are a little bit blurred, I find, sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken about this a little bit in previous episodes, but it's like, if you assume a creative mindset and you're kind and nice enough to yourself to see yourself that way, I mean, you never really turn it off. I mean, I see this a lot with design and art director students. Once you start to see compositions, you can't stop seeing them. So everywhere you walk around, you're walking down the street to get lunch, you're almost like framing up a photo and you see bits of beauty and opportunity everywhere, which is pretty rewarding.
It is. I'm very much sort of into experiments and stuff like that. So, for example, if you would walk on a Sunday walk, I don't know what you do on a Sunday, but let's say that it's, you know, a nice fall day outside and like crispy weather and all that, and just bring a camera. Just bring the camera. You don't have to take any pictures, but just by having the camera, you will start looking at the world through a different lens, pun intended. and that feeling is what you walk around with if you work as a creative and you're in a flow and you're for example, in a project or whatever, you're always switched on. And so that's what I mean with the sort of blurred line. So the brain is always working, which is fun. But back to that dinner, it's not always fun being creative either. I mean, because it can come with some, you know, a certain amount of anxiety.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, as we've previously mentioned, you spend a lot of time not having great ideas. So it's like, it's hard work. You know, it's the kind of thinking and stuff that you can't do with a hangover. You can't stay up too late. Like, you need to look after your mind and body because you need to perform mentally, which is like, which is pretty demanding. And it's really rewarding, but really demanding at the same time.
Yeah. What do you think is the most rewarding part about that?
I really like that it's something that you just get better and better at over time.
Mm.
So I think that's one really interesting thing that you notice over time, that your attitudes change. But sometimes they don't. Sometimes you keep that kind of naivety and passion. Passion's a thing that gets used a lot with jobs. And it's like, it's hard to be passionate about something that you turn up and do 5 days a week or, I don't know, it's interesting. But Chris, what do you think about people who make a really kind of strategic decision to use their spare time as their creative outlet? What's your take on that?
I think it's absolutely fantastic because if you work as a creative, your expected output is always to come up with something fantastic, and you need to like solve a problem that hasn't been solved before, or you need to do something in a better way that's ever been done before and all of that. And so all of a sudden your creativity is capped into this world where it needs to perform, and it's not just being creative for creativity's sake. And so when you actually invest in sort of creative processes outside of your work, then your creativity is just for fun and just for exploration and just for you. And I think that's important to kind of keep that rather than just see it as a means of transaction.
One really nice thing about you being the total boss of your free time is that if you work with, you know, the communication industry, you need to get a lot of people to agree that the new thing is good.
Mm.
So you've got a lot of stakeholders, and you, even if you do have good ideas that kind of align with your objectives and your problem solving, all that, there's still a lot of no's. So I think there's something really positive about it just being up to you and you being in control of your free time and your project, side projects and stuff like that.
And it's a really effective way to kind of keep that passion. I mean, the reason why you sought out a creative job in the first place, to keep that spark going, I think you need to have an output in a world, or you need to have some kind of forum where you can explore, and it's not going to be judged, it's not going to be sold, it's not going to, you know, we talked about constraints in the previous episode, and you should definitely set up constraints for yourself when you do it as a passion project as well. But no one's really going to care if you oblige by those constraints or not. It's just for your own sort of creative process. But I think it's important because to have output, you need to have input. And sometimes you can create your own input just by being creative outside of work, I think.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think it's a great place to experiment. And it's like there's a phrase which is like, you know, you need to keep your knife sharp and you need to kind of develop yourself. And I guess like in lots of ways, keep yourself curious and interested. And the stuff that you do after hours almost always creeps into your day job, whether or not you're a cafe owner who travels a lot and all of a sudden the decor and decoration of your cafe is a bit more, you know, a bit more worldly, or if you're a creative in a more traditional sense, your hobbies and your interest in the stuff you do away turns up after lunch and in the morning.
Yeah, and I mean, your imagination is your tool.
Yeah.
For example, if you're a doctor, now, I mean, I don't know anything what it's like to work as a medic, but if you're a doctor, then you have a certain set of rules that you have to solve problems in a certain way, because that's how biology works, for example. When it comes to creativity and communication, it's so contextual, it's so personal, and it's so interspersed with like aesthetic, you know, taste and all of that. So if your tool is unsharp, then the output is not going to be that great. So you have a responsibility to make sure that your brain has the all the resources it needs for it to perform at the level that you want it to.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So if we move on to the idea that all jobs are creative, I think one really nice thing to look at is to almost look at creativity like herbs and spices. Because it's the kind of, it's a technique or an approach or a skill or a thing that you can sprinkle over everything.
Mm.
And it kind of makes lots of things better.
Oh, yeah.
So I think like, you know, it's very easy to think that if you're an analyst or a consultant or an engineer or a doctor, that those kind of jobs don't really require creativity. I think that they really do.
Oh, they do, 100%. I have a friend that I used to hang out with like a few years back, and she's a tax lawyer. Maybe the least creative job out there in a lot of people's eyes. But in her opinion, she thought it was super creative. She's like, I'm a creative. I work with tax law because it's all about, and back to the constraints again, the hoops that you have to go through and all of the sort of different exceptions to the rules and like all of that. So for her, the way she approached her job as a lawyer was through a sort of a creative lens, and she loved it. And she's like one of the best in Sweden at it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I can't think of a more creative person than a good, than a great tax lawyer. I think that's like...
And also she did not send money to like the Caymans. That was not her response, but like the way she interprets the law and the way she can use the law and all of those constraints to really kind of create change. And I think that's creativity in a nutshell, really, because understanding, and you have all these like super hard boundaries, how can you still make things in a new way? That, I mean, for me, I was just, when I heard her talk, I was like, okay, you're more creative than me. Maybe we should just, you know, switch jobs.
I think it's like, it's really, I mean, the constraints are right there. They're hard and they're concrete. And you've got such a focus on achieving a goal that seems to, you know, oppose those rules. And it's like, yeah, it's super interesting. What other jobs do you think are more creative than a lot of us give credit for?
I think something really creative happened when Uber was introduced to this part of the world. Because something as, like, basic as a taxi ride just all of a sudden was like a customer service experience. And you know, they had like little mints and they had like you know, water bottle and all of that, just because they wanted reviews, obviously. But it kind of enhanced the entire experience for me as a taxi rider and and for the chauffeur as well, because you know, everyone was nice, and it was just that incentive to kind of make the whole thing better made just like both of us actually try harder. And it was like a little creative spice, if you will.
Yeah, totally.
Just to make the entire thing a completely different experience. And I think that's really beautiful in a way.
I mean, I think if you grew up in a world before Uber, you just assumed that the laws of nature dictated that catching a taxi kind of sucked. You'd be on the phone, you'd be on hold, or you'd be on an impossible website that didn't work properly on your phone. The guy looks like he's been in his white shirt for 11 days.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, in Sweden, back in sort of the early 90s and 90s, if you took a cab ride, the driver actually sat within a plexiglass shell because of protection from the people catching the cab.
Yeah.
And with Uber, that all changed. Because if you would to misbehave, then you could never book another Uber. So it was like an incentive for both parties to really make an effort to make that a good experience.
Yeah, I think that like that brings us to another interesting point. So if you're looking at your career and what you might want to do to bring a bit more creativity, I mean, we're recording this in Stockholm. Bergs is based in Stockholm, as most of you may or may not know. But there's a huge, crazy, thriving startup scene here. And I think that like there is such, you know, it's almost in the air that there is permission to try these wacky, great, bold, ambitious things. And I think the local startup scene in Stockholm is a great example of creativity in a really pragmatic way. You know, there's a whole bunch of teams that are a couple of people just, you know, taking on the giants or taking on the convention or bad habits or all that kind of stuff. So I think that's another good example.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, we now see industries who've been associated with maybe not so much creativity, such as finance and you know, the medical field and all that, being reinvented. How do you meet your doctor? The doctor is now in your pocket. The whole sort of banking experience is completely changed for the past sort of 5 years. So there's a lot of industries that historically has not been associated with sort of creativity that really has kind of changed the game.
Yeah, I mean, COVID was a bit of a kick for a lot of companies to stop a lot of habits that just went unchallenged for a long time. You know, I think there's a good reason to work at home sometimes. I think that's good for your productivity, your mind, your body, your work-life balance. So it's like, it takes some of these interruptions to get rid of bad habits.
So, Adam, where do you think, where's the next creative revolution gonna kick off? In which industry do you think is facing a new sort of creative revolution?
I mean, that's a good question. And if I knew the answer to that, I'd be probably one of Stockholm's startup scene kind of members. But so we're starting to get to this point where more people are working out of the office. I think there's going to be more and more of a rise in what is kind of known as like the digital nomad. So people that can work wherever they're plugged into the internet and wherever their laptop is, I reckon.
Mm.
So I think it's like, I think it's the things around those formats of working, because it's like, you know, if you can call into Zoom, if you can jump on Slack or Microsoft Teams and you've proven yourself in the past to be, you know, responsible and productive and a good team player wherever you are. I think that the idea of like having a set home is something that a lot of people will question a bit more, especially at different life stages. I mean, you know, kids might be a bit weird, but like, I think if you're in your 20s or 30s, I don't know, I think that would be pretty cool.
Going back to the, you know, your brain being your most important tool. That's a huge privilege, because you can work from wherever you want, basically. You're not actually, you don't necessarily need to be at a, you know, at a hospital to meet your patients, or you have to be at the bank to sign legal papers or anything like that. You can work from wherever you want, and that is one of the reasons actually why I got into this industry, because one of the things that I value most is the power of my own time. And having said that, I know that I'm working quite a lot, but I do it in my own terms. And for me, that was super important. And I did not really necessarily realize that when I first started, but I've noticed that as I'm, you know, getting more and more into this career. And I value that so much, just to be able to, you know, I can work from a cabin in Norway. I can work, and I mean, I'm based in Copenhagen, but I work at Berg School of Communication in Stockholm. And that just sort of the digital nomad thing, because it just works. We're now in a time and age where that works, as long as you know, what's expected of you and how to collaborate. And I think that's another point. When we're moving into this sort of digital realm, different skill sets are being more and more in demand, such as collaboration. How do you collaborate with people? How do you collaborate with a team if you're not physically in the room? And so that's something that I think is going to be the next sort of step in this evolution of creative work, because the creative work, especially within the communication industry, historically has very much been take a copywriter and art director, shove them in a room, and just wait for the magic to happen. And so we've been very sort of focused on sort of the closeness, physical closeness, yeah, of a space in order to kind of solve problems. And that's being challenged at a sort of global level.
Like, I think that comes down to being more deliberate in your communication, because I think communication, you know, we've got the rules and conventions and ideas of how we work when we're all in the same room. But I think as soon as you're remote, and being remote just means like, if you're in the room next door, or if you're in Thailand, it's all about the same. You know, you're all on a screen. So, you know, you need to be more deliberate about that communication process. That's definitely something that we've focused on here, and we're a communication school, so we're really sensitive about that. But the fact that when I speak to my friends and family, they're reporting those same issues, I think really, you know, makes it a number one priority.
So I used to work at this international network of agencies, and they were pretty good and early on developed a way to collaborate when you're not physically in the same room. And that to me was kind of, it was pretty cool to see how the whole thing was set up. Because I remember we worked on a huge pitch for one of the biggest sort of airline companies in the world. And the timeline was super short. And so what we did is we set up teams in Stockholm, in New York, Los Angeles, Singapore, Dubai, and yeah, so that kind of covers the entire globe. So the pitch was actually being worked on 24/7, but the teams did not have to work 24/7.
Yeah.
And so they made the most of the fact that people were in different time zones and that they were around the world. And so the work got really, it was very, very interesting because all of the different sort of cultural perspectives, and also the work never ended, like they never stopped.
Yeah.
So it was just a continuous sort of iterative loop of developing this pitch. So within, you know, a week and a half, we did work that was, you know, equivalent to 3 months. It was incredible.
Yeah, I used to, so when I was doing freelance work in Paris for Australian clients, it was the time zone. I mean, time zones can not always be your friend.
No.
We all know that. I'm sure we've all been on weird conference calls at too late o'clock at night. But like, it was really nice because they could brief me or touch base at the end of their business day, and it would be the start of my day. And then by the time they got back to the office, I'd bounced back some work. Mm. So it's like, there's ways to make this stuff work in your advantage. And I think you made a really interesting point previously, feeling a bit more in control of your time and your environment and your work. I think that's like one thing that I think COVID's taught us is that, you know, sometimes it's nice not to have a middle manager walking around kind of snooping about what's on your screen, because like most people are responsible adults that do their job.
Mm.
They don't need a guy called Brad to come and check up on them. They don't, do you know what I mean? Like they don't need undue managing. They need people that help get problems out of their way and kind of then get out of the way so that they can do work. So anything that kind of makes you more empowered to work the way that works best for you, I think is good.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's no right and wrong here. But going back to, again, to that point that, you know, your mind and your brain is your most important tool. You need to understand what works for you. So do you need to sit in a room with people? Then make sure that you're in that kind of environment. If you don't need that and you value your sort of your own time management, and that helps you be free and creative, then do that. And I think now we have the option to actually choose. That was not the case a few years back, mm-hmm. just like 1 year back, really. Because then if you were the guy who wanted to sort of work out of office, they were like, oh, he's asocial and weird. But now that's a part of the norm as much as it is to actually sit with someone. So I think it's opened up new options and for people to have the opportunity to kind of fine tune the way they want to work so that they work in the best possible way.
Okay, I've got a question for you, and I'm very curious to see what your thoughts are, but how do you feel when people say that, you know, and it's a bit of a trope or a cliche that, like, you know, you should follow your passion and do work that you're passionate about? Is that something you've heard before?
It is something I've heard before, and it's something I've told myself as well. On paper, yes.
Yeah.
On paper, absolutely. But I think the reality is, if you want to have a career and you want to work within a specific sort of genre or category or industry or whatever, the reality is work is not always going to be fun. And if you're going to be that picky, just working on the things that you really, 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 really want to do, then first you have to work for about 15 years so that you become the best in the world at it, because that's when you can get picky.
Yeah, exactly. Otherwise,
I think be deliberate in sort of where you look for work. Because if you work as a creative, you have the power to kind of get the brief into a direction that harmonize with your values and all of that. And also do stuff outside of work. Again, because that's there you have all the power. I think it's important to do things that you believe in. Otherwise, especially if you do it like over a period of time, if you do stuff that you don't care about for a long period of time, it's going to be boring, and then you're going to suck at it probably because you don't put in that extra, you know, 5-10%. But you can't expect to always do exactly what you want to do. That's just not the reality of things.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's like, maybe it's just something that you grow up with or you experience more in Australia, but there's that real concept of like, you know, find something that you're passionate about. And it almost goes back to like the creative genius, like this one spark area of the world that is calling you, and that is almost like your fate to work in and innovate in and do that kind of stuff.
And I mean, sure, do that, but then maybe you need to be sort of mindful of what industry you're in. I mean, if you have that goal and you have that sort of outlook on your career, then maybe you should not work as a, you know, commercial creative. maybe then you should work as an artist and really do whatever you want.
Yep, I agree. There's a really interesting kind of Venn diagram, so like three overlapping circles that kind of all intersect. And it's by a guy called Scott Galloway, who's a marketing professor at NYU. And the three circles are like, you should try to find a job where you'll get paid for it, so something that is like financially rewarding enough. You also want to find a job that doesn't suck. So I guess, you know, working on an oil rig, working on covert military operations might not be great for like a lifestyle if you value being close to your family and all that kind of stuff. So a job that doesn't suck for you, and then also something that you're good at. And I think that something that you're good at is a nice proxy or representation of the stuff that you're curious about and passionate about. And I think it's about aligning those things, because I think if you get too Californian about this and a bit too kind of, you know, self-help book, you're not going to find, you know, like, you know, your a day job can really hurt sometimes if it's your passion.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember a colleague saying that I'm in this self-induced sort of manic depressive state where as a creative, you work and when things are going your way and the ideas are flowing, you're on the highest high because everything's possible and it's amazing. And as soon as you present it and then the client says, no, we don't like red, so you change the whole thing, you're, you know, at the very bottom. And so you're always going up and down, and that's because you do care.
Yeah.
And I think that Venn diagram is really good, and it kind of applies to everything in life, really. I have my own little Venn diagram, and I did not make that up, so I'm not going to take credit for it, but it kind of works when it comes to what kind of projects are we taking on? And then it's fun, fame, fortune. And it should always include two of those.
Okay, what's the fun bit? I think I understand.
So fun, it's a fun project. Do I care, like, is this something that I really enjoy doing? Or do I think the product, service, or client is, like, well worth my time and I think they're doing a fantastic job, but I want to help? That's fun.
Yeah.
Fame, obviously, is this something that a lot of people are going to see? Because if it does, it helps your business grow. And then it's, you know, it can get accolades and all of that stuff. And fortune, not necessarily that, you know, we're getting paid millions, but is there enough money in this to kind of say yes to it? And if it's just fun and money, then perfect combo. If it's not that fun, but it's very public and everyone's going to see it and you get paid for it, then it's also kind of worth doing, as long as it doesn't sort of go against, you know, your values and stuff like that, obviously. But it kind of helps to make sure that you also have a mix with the different projects that you're working on. Some are just bread and butter. They just need to, you know, pay the rent and get, you know, get the machinery going. And some are just like really not a lot of money, but it gives you so much creative sort of energy and inspiration and stuff that will also then spill over to other projects. So it's important to have those three in some shape or form.
Yeah, I really like the mix of stuff that you get when you set up a little system like that for your thoughts and your decision making, because all of a sudden you're intuitively going to have a mix of projects in your weeks or months or years.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really interesting thing. So in this next section, I want to talk a little bit about some of the traditional jobs that you think of when you think about creative thinkers, and then some of the more commercial creative jobs that are options for people in their career. We're a communication school and we have lots of experience with certain areas. But when you think of like a creative job or a creative career, you often think of like, you know, you think of J.K. Rowling, you know, you think of authors sitting alone and typing masterpieces and then earning millions. You think of musicians who make everyone feel love in a uniquely powerful way and earn millions. You think of artists who make crazy, beautiful, weird stuff. Maybe they and earn millions. And then you know, there's the world of like acting. So you grow up thinking that those cultural industries are the main place where creative jobs happen. But I don't think that's true. And we're a communication school, and we have a lot of courses that kind of support and build people's careers in lots of different areas. I just wanted to take a little bit of time to walk you through what some of those things are without turning it into too much of an ad, just so that you've got a good overview of what some of your options might be.
Interesting. how should we divide it? Because, I mean, there's one thing, sort of, if we want to divide it into visual creative, like textual and creative, which is the category for, like, you know, the writers and the copywriters and the script writers and the playwrights and all of that, sort of working with the words to kind of help people feel and be moved and, you know, spark new ideas. And then we have the sort of the visual spectrum, which is sort of designers and art directors and stylists and people who construct things and stuff like that. But then we also have the sort of the tech field, which is like just creating new apps and creating new platforms and interfaces.
Yeah.
And that's also creative. And I remember we actually went with the whole school, sort of the staff at school, to a school in Paris called École 42, which means School 42. And it's called 42 because that's apparently the answer to the question, what's the purpose of life, according to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. They said, so they teach code, programming code. And their whole philosophy around that was that historically and like traditionally, code is always being categorized, if you look at a uni, from sort of the science perspective.
Yeah, it's a science or engineering kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. But their perspective was it's not science, it's culture. Because code evolves. It's a language that evolves and you can create new code and you can challenge sort of, you can create stuff with code that makes people feel things and changes their behavior. And so they were like, it's actually a cultural sort of, it's in the realm of culture, social science rather than tech science.
Yeah, but even the more formal side of it. So if you talk to developers or programmers or whatever, they often talk about like beautiful solutions or beautiful code. And that is like something that's small, well-organized, is as minimal as possible, is really smart and clever. So even in the code, without looking at the user side of what that software does, you know, it can be beautiful.
It's very Matrix.
Yeah, well, they almost like compare it to poetry. They kind of get a bit gushy about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I like when other parts of the world blow up to be creative and beautiful that you haven't even thought of.
Mm.
I mean, that's cool. That's one nice thing.
Yeah. You know, if we're going to get very specific with different roles, I mean, we have copywriters.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
And a copywriter is a person who is a wordsmith, basically. They have that power to tell something complicated in a very short amount of time in a very uncomplicated way, which is a craft that I do not have.
Yeah, they're the commercial version of Ernest Hemingway.
Just exactly.
Crisp, short, sharp, direct, and really focused on creating a feeling or an outcome.
Yeah, exactly. And then we have art directors.
We do. And then we have designers. And I really want to, I want your opinion on how you separate world of design from the world of art direction, because it's something that I still struggle with a little bit, if I'm very honest.
I mean, to be honest, I've tried to explain to my mom what an art director does, and I still haven't managed to do that 12 years later. But an art director, in my opinion, does the same thing as a copywriter. So for me, an art director and a copywriter is exactly the same not the same title, obviously, but they do the same thing. It's just when it comes to the actual execution that it kind of separates. Because what they do, what they have in common is that they develop concepts and they develop whole worlds in which you can communicate a certain product, service, feeling, emotion, opinion, whatever. So they dramatize the whole sort of the concept. And then an art director's responsibility is to kind of dress that concept in some kind of visual world. You can study to become a designer and then work as an art director.
Totally. They're skill sets that flow back and forth very fluidly, very quickly, and very often.
Yeah. But I would say a designer is often much more crafty.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
than an art director.
Exactly. The way I describe art direction is kind of like the focus on the visual communication of an idea. So really at that kind of higher, slightly more conceptual and strategically aligned level and less aligned with the executional details, which I think designers are total brilliant craftspeople that are probably better at the mechanics of visual communication and visual stuff.
Yeah.
And they often, honestly, they swap roles probably.
And also, I mean, depending on where you work, if you study to become a communication designer or a graphic designer or motion designer, and then you start working at a fashion magazine, for example, you're going to be called an art director.
Yeah.
And also, if you work as an art director within film, you do not necessarily work with communication concepts. So
no.
Then you're more into sort of styling and set design and that kind of world. So it's a very loose term, but if we want to limit it to sort of the communication industry, just to make it a clear point in this conversation that we're having now, I think it's exactly what you said before. Responsible for sort of the overall overarching sort of visual concept of an idea.
Yeah, it sounds kind of ambiguous sometimes.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of is sometimes. I mean, next up we have like UX designers and people that really focus on the design of user experiences. And often they're working in digital contexts. So that's a relatively new thing. I mean, art directors have been around for decades and decades and decades and, I don't know, 100 years? I don't know. It's a long time. Whereas like UX designers really rose with the computing revolution. So they're often looking at either a user experience in the wider sense, and we can get to that soon, or like how you interface with a website, app, whatever, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But sort of the wider angle on that, it's UX stands for user experience. And user experience is... it can also be translated into the physical world, and then it's called sort of wayfinding.
Yeah, exactly.
It can be that. So, for example, how is it that you will always find your gate when you walk into a new airport? It's because someone has thought about how to sort of communicate in which direction to go, when to go, how long it takes to get there, all of that stuff. That's actually UX as well. It's just in the physical space.
It's funny you mentioned airports. I remember reading that there was a design company that were responsible for getting people to their gate on time. And not only did they have big signs everywhere, but there was a little arrow shape on the carpet that kind of directed you subconsciously to mainly where most people needed to end up, which I thought was really clever.
Yeah, very. Nudging.
Yeah, exactly. Nudging without knowing you're being nudged.
And then strategy. Is strategy creative?
Yeah, well, this is a really good point. I just did an online strategy course over summer. So I now see strategy with even more respect than I had. And I already had a soft spot for strategy. And I would think that it's like absolutely an act of creativity because you're pulling together lots of existing things, whether it's insights into people or your brand or companies or culture, and you're speculating and recompiling ideas to create something new. And even if those ideas are kind of a strategic direction or a decision about, you know, what should we be doing as a company or a school or a government or anything.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've seen a lot of strategy briefs. Creative briefs from strategy. And I think a good strategist knows the difference between facts and insights. Because to end up with an insight, that needs creativity. To be able to kind of connect the dots and then draw a conclusion that is based in facts. It's based in the need of the company or organization. And it also sparks a creative idea. So that's like the bridge from facts into a creative world. And to be able to come up with a good, well-formulated insight takes a stroke of creativity, definitely.
Yeah, and it really is the springboard that a lot of other people use to kind of jump out and have ideas in a certain direction. And it also gives you a little bit of a benchmark or something to measure against, which is really important. As a creative person, as a creative professional, strategy people are some of my favorite and most loved and most important people. I like the curiosity of how their brains work often.
Yeah. And they share that thing that we talked about in the previous episode, curiosity. Because they look at the world and they really observe it and they're like, what does that mean? And they, you know, they go into details that, you know, for the untrained eye, you might just miss and not pay attention to. But that's sort of the key to unlocking this whole new world. So they love strategy. I think we both can say that.
And that brings us to PR or public relations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I must confess, PR is something that I have not had a huge amount to do with in my life.
Mm.
I've lived a very sheltered existence away from PR.
Well, you've definitely had a lot to do with PR. You might not have known it. So PR is really creativity as well. It's a very creative sort of craft, because what they do is that they come up with ideas that doesn't necessarily need media. But the ideas in itself is so worthy to talk about that people talk about it around their dinner table. They talk to their friends about it. So they have, they focus on the sort of earned attention at the core of the idea. For example, a good example is Café Latte. So in Sweden, in the sort of early 90s, everyone was starting to drink latte. And obviously, PR didn't invent latte, but they introduced latte to the Swedish population as this continental drink, blah, blah. And it was actually paid for by the milk companies, because the main ingredients in latte is milk. And yeah. So it was a very clever way of making the demand for milk increase by creating this whole new lifestyle around it that everyone talked about. They didn't talk about milk. They talked about latte, but they bought the milk to get the latte.
No, exactly. And I think it's like, it's really interesting. Once you start to learn more and more about PR as an industry, I think you read the news a little bit more skeptically and a little bit more with a bit more of an education or an insight into how did this story end up on my news website and things like that. And I think it's good to be media literate and to know that stuff. I mean, I think that it's like there's legitimately interesting insights. They're often doing surveys to find attitudes about things. So they're often looking at like what's happening in contemporary culture around different ideas and different kind of movements and trends and stuff like that. So super interesting. But again, I'm like, I must admit, I'm a little bit blind to PR.
Yeah, right.
Should I mention this on a podcast?
Why not? I mean, I think it's to kind of pinpoint where PR sits in this whole ecosystem, going back to Venn diagram, if you have one circle on the left side being strategy and creativity and sort of concept on the right side, PR is like right bang in the middle.
And it's often used to, it often stitches lots of other disciplines together. I mean, you'll find that there's a whole lot of PR people that write brilliantly, that know the visual language of communication really well. You know, they kind of bring lots of things together into one area.
They do. And they know, their craft is to know what people care about.
Yeah, I think they do it really well.
Yeah, they do it fantastically. I mean, when they do it well, they do it fantastically.
Also, when they do it well, they do it in such a way that we don't know they do it well. And that might be their genius.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I think that almost wraps things up. But Christopher, do you have anything to add or any last piece of advice to people that are thinking about creativity and how that might turn into their job or their work?
I think it's a matter of not necessarily looking at your job as a creative or not creative job, but rather, like you said before, use the spices that you have because you have a creative mind. So just make sure that you use that and because it's really about realizing a bigger potential. And you can solve whatever task you have in front of you at your everyday job in probably hundreds or even thousands of different ways. And so it's just add that flavor and you will see that you're going to end up with a different result and it's going to be more fun.
Often if I'm talking to a group of people, I describe communication skills and creativity as a thing that kind of makes your entire day better. So, you know, you get better at problem solving at work or in your job, no matter what that is. You get better at negotiating with your kids and your family. You get better at surprise weekends for your partner. Like it kind of improves, you know, it's a layer that improves everything. It's the MSG of skills.
Without being toxic, hopefully.
Exactly. Thank you, Christopher.
Well, thank you.
I think we're about done.
All right. What are we going to talk about in the next episode?
The next episode is a really good one, and I know it's one that we're both really passionate about, and we're going to talk about why creativity matters. So I'm really looking forward to that one.
Excellent. I look forward to it. So see you then.
Sounds good. Bye for now.
Bye.
I'll edit that arm out.
Yeah.